Hello, and welcome back to the History of Australia podcast. As always, before we start, I do want to acknowledge that this podcast is being produced on traditional Kaurna land, and recognise the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region. I also pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future. Last week, we overviewed a significant amount of political developments which were occurring around the colonies of Australia. This week, we'll continue those trends, as we discuss the ends of both Van Diemen's Land Governor Wilmot and New South Wales Governor Gipps, due to the respective issues both were facing in their colonies. In addition, we'll also take the time today to talk about both Charles Sturt's inland journey, attempting to find the fabled inland sea, and Ludwig Leidhardt's doom journey from the Darling Downs towards Perth. We'll also take some time to discuss the smaller, but still relevant ongoings throughout Australia during the period of 1844 until 1847. To start, we'll work through the two explorers' journeys who I just mentioned. The first, Ludwig Leidhardt, was a German explorer who, after studying natural sciences across Europe, had arrived in Sydney in 1842 with the explicit goal of exploring inland Australia. To facilitate this, he'd initially self-fund a specimen collection journey, moving between New South Wales and modern-day Queensland. However, this did not find any support or real acknowledgement throughout the New South Wales colonial government. Not one to be deterred, Ludwig would push to take part in an expedition proposed by the Legislative Council, a journey from Moreton Bay all the way to Port Essington, 300 kilometres north of modern-day Darwin, to be led by Surveyor General Sir Thomas Mitchell. However, the expedition would be called off by Governor Gipps, who believed that it was too dangerous and expensive to undertake. This would apparently irritate Ludwig, so I guess we can add him to those in the colony who greatly disliked Gipps. Once again, not someone who was easily deterred, Ludwig would decide on leading an expedition of volunteers on the same route, financed through private means. He and five other men would sail from Sydney in August 1844, and would be joined by four more men once they reached Moreton Bay. They would leave from Jimbor, the furthest outpost in that region, on the 1st of October. The journey would not be easy, with two of the men leaving the party and returning at one point, while on the 28th of June, 1845, one of their members, John Gilbert, would be killed in an indigenous raid on their camp. Despite these issues, Ludwig and the men would make it to Port Essington, where a small colonial outpost existed in the same vein as those like nearby Fort Dundas and Fort Wellington, which you have discussed prior, reaching it on the 17th of December, having trekked over 4,800 kilometres or around 3,000 miles. The expedition would return to Sydney on the Herewen by late March 1846, having spent a year and a half away from any colonial settlement. The party had been presumed dead by those throughout the colony, so their return was met with both surprise and relief. Ludwig would be named the Prince of Explorers due to this expedition, with his party receiving acclaim across the colony, alongside a government grant of £1,000, as well as private donations up to £1,500. Ludwig would use his journey to expand his fame across both Europe and Australia, preparing his journal to be published and giving lectures on his findings, while also preparing a more daring second expedition to cross from the Darling Downs all the way to the Swan River. Funding with his part of the party's reward, he gathered a party of eight and would journey from the Darling Downs in December 1836. This expedition would be ill-fated, however, as rather quickly, the group would be delayed by significant rain, and left without much food when the animals they had brought with them strayed from the party. Ludwig, determined as ever, attempted to keep the party going along, but a fever would take many of the parties, forcing them to retreat after covering only 800 kilometers. Ludwig would find himself in significant hot water here due to his failure to bring a medical kit, a failure which nearly brought about mutiny. And soon enough, it seems that the Prince of Explorers had suffered some type of breakdown, which greatly infected his ability to lead. His party would be led back to the Darling Downs through the leadership of Indigenous guide Harry Brown, with older men making it back alive. Ludwig would go on to blame the men of the party for the expedition's failure, essentially calling them weak, while they in turn would blame his leadership. Whatever the case, Ludwig would only rest for a fortnight before heading north to cross-reference notes of his journey north with that of Mitchell's. We'll actually talk more about Ludwig next week, as his next expedition is even more ill-fated than this one. But for now, we leave him near Brisbane, looking at the notes of another man's expedition north. That man is Surveyor General Thomas Mitchell. I know I didn't make reference to him in the introduction, but he does play a role in the journeys to Port Essington. Mitchell has a long history of controversy by this point, which we will discuss likely in a future episode. But suffice to say that even now he was a figure of infamy. At the time of the 1844 Port Phillip by-election, Mitchell had already been the Surveyor General for years. This did not stop him from standing for the by-election and getting voted in after promising to separate the region from New South Wales. Gipps was far from happy due to this, mostly due to the concept of a governor official sitting on the legislature and likely voting against the government, and essentially commanded that Mitchell could do as he pleases in his role as member for Port Phillip, but that as Surveyor General, he must obey and support the government. A dichotomy which was nearly impossible to reconcile, leading him to resign in August. Notwithstanding this controversy, Mitchell would find himself in the sphere of the Port Essington expeditions, despite Gipps not supporting a government-funded expedition there. Having made multiple attempts prior, he would leave from Boree in December 1845, hoping to find not only a route to the northern outpost, but also a great river flowing northwest, in the region of Maranao, Warrego, and the Belayendo rivers. Despite trekking for a year until late December 1846, he would find neither a route to Port Essington, nor the Great River, though he believed that he had found such a river, and suggested so in his account of the journey. While Mitchell's journey may not seem super relevant, it does show how soon his goals would be met by another in Ludwig, considering the timeframes, and helps us understand the level of exploration which was being undertaken at this time by the colonists and the colonies. Our final explorer today is that of Charles Sturt, and his expedition is to find the Inland Sea, that totally, 100%, no doubt about it, exists. By this point, Sturt's quite the accomplished individual throughout the colonies. Having been the first European to find the mouth of the Murray River, and having become a significant figure in South Australia, working as its Surveyor General for a time, and also being the chair on the bench of magistrates who investigated the Rufus River massacre and found that Protector Morehouse acted in a conduct that was justifiable. However, this level of prestige, or at least notoriety, would not last long. As when Governor Grey replaced Gawler, Charles would write to the colonial officers, complaining about the choice, and offering himself as a replacement, an affront which the new governor would never truly forgive. Grey would do little to elevate Sturt during his time as governor, refusing his appointment to become colonial secretary, and soon enough his pay was cut as his role was reduced. Sturt had, by this point, become deep in debt, with little potential for things to get better. After being rejected in his request for either compensation or transfer to another colony, Sturt believed that the only way he could elevate himself now was through some grandiose move. Through this, he decided that the best course of action was to explore and document the entire interior of the Australian continent, and find the inland sea he was certain existed once and for all. He sent this plan to the colonial office through ex-Governor Darling, whom he had remained friends with. And despite getting censured from the Executive Council due to clashes with Grey, he would receive approval for the plan, albeit far more limited in scope, to conduct his expedition. This approval simply allowed him to penetrate the centre of the continent in an attempt to establish the existence of a mountain range near latitude 28 south. Taking this as his last chance, Sturt would gather a group of 16 men, as well as a boat and 200 sheep, and depart from Adelaide on the 10th of August 1844. The group would quickly reach the Murray River and its junction with the Darling, before camping for 2 months near Lake Corndilla, making smaller scouting expeditions beyond the Barrier Range. Despite both a shortage of water and possible signs of scurvy appearing in December, Sturt continued to push the party north into the Grey Range, managing to find a source of water at Depot Glen on Preservation Creek. However, the summer would dry up all other water sources, and from the 27th of January until the 16th of July, Sturt and his men would be genuinely trapped here, unable to leave due to a lack of water in any direction. Sturt's second-in-command, James Poole, would succumb to scurvy, while the rest of the men and their horses suffered incredibly due to the heat. It was only with heavy rain that the group could finally leave, moving northwest to Fort Grey, where Sturt and the men built up a small outpost which included vegetables. Sturt, still under the impression that he had no other choice but to continue this expedition if he were to better his status, would continue to push northward, eventually committing to a 700 plus kilometer journey to the center of the continent. He and his men would not reach it. They would first be rebuffed by the appearance of what was essentially a sea of sand with massive dunes, what we know today as the Simpson Desert, but they would continue by skirting around it. Further north though, they would encounter another desert, the Stony Desert, where erosion had caused the sandstone floor, which Sturt mistakenly suggested may have been an ancient seafloor, to be eroded into desert pavement or gibber. This compacted stones would cause the horses to limp and wore down the hooves of any remaining sheep, creating another massive barrier for the expedition. They would somehow manage even further north, to parts of Cooper's Creek where there was greenery, but would once again be rebuked when everything around them became salt and sand once more. Finally deterred, Sturt would return his party to Fort Grey in October, having abandoned his belief in a great inland sea. However, upon their return, Sturt would propose that every man besides himself and James McDougal Stewart should head back to Adelaide. While the two of them essentially undertook a suicide mission to find the centre. He would be taken out of this delusion by the party surgeon, Jay Brown, and the group would head back to Adelaide together. On the trek back, Sturt would nearly die to an attack of scurvy, with Brown taking over for the most part. Recovering on indigenous foods, Sturt would arrive back in Adelaide on the 19th of January, 1846, a few days ahead of his party, having failed to find the centre of the continent nor the inland sea. Sturt, alongside Ludwig and Mitchell, represent a core idea amongst Australian explorers of this time. Europeans who were so desperate to achieve notoriety and prestige that they would undertake deadly expeditions to do so. While all did discover new regions for their colonies, the risk they undertook often did outweigh the rewards. During this period, a few major things would be occurring in South Australia. Firstly, the colony would see its first boom with the discovery of copper deposits at Burra. Having been discovered by a shepherd who had sold the information for £8, with blasting beginning in late September 1846 to promising results. The SA Mining Association would be floated, with its £5 shares reaching the price of £30. Burra wouldn't be the first big mining find in the colony, with copper being found back in Kapunda in 1842, and silver and lead being found even earlier in Glen Osmond. But it would be the most prosperous for a while, with the small town eventually supplying 89% of the colony's copper, alongside 5% of the world's copper for a period of 15 years during the 1850s and 60s. As this boom occurred, political movements would also be happening. Governor Grey, having stabilised the colony and brought its many problems into check, was to be replaced by Frederick Holt Robe. This replacement had nothing to do with any negatives of Grey. Unlike many of the other replacements across the colonies which happened, and are going to happen this episode, and rather was actually due to his effectiveness. The Colonial Office believed that Grey's style of leadership was now better suited to New Zealand. We'll actually talk about Grey's time in New Zealand next week, during the minisode which is replacing a normal episode. But suffice to say, the Colonial Office believed his authoritarian efficiency was needed elsewhere. Grey would be replaced by Governor Robe in late October 1845, and this would turn out to be a boon for the man who we've talked about a lot during this episode, Charles Sturt. Upon his return to Adelaide, he would find Grey gone, and with Robe as his replacement, would receive a promotion to Colonial Treasurer, which made his desperation prior completely meaningless. Thought I'd just add that in here. These political movements were not contained to only South Australia, as you already know. The saga of Governor Wilmot continues in Van Diemen's Land this week. Before we get into his end as governor, I do want to note that he was the founder of the Van Diemen's Land Royal Society for Horticulture, Botany, and the Advancement of Science. What's interesting to us is that this would be the first royal society established outside the United Kingdom. And this is especially interesting considering that this happened in Van Diemen's Land and not in another colony, such as in Sydney or in Canada or the Americas. Despite this success, it would still be considered a detriment to Wilmot's popularity in the colony, as it had clashed with a society created by the previous governor, Franklin. At the same time, Wilmot would clash with the Bishop Francis Nixon over the role of religious institutes in the colony. Wilmot would be also accused of licentious behaviour in a publication, which carried over to both New South Wales and England. And even though influential colonists, such as John Petter, declared them to be false, many in the colony believed them. This would be one of the final straws on the camel's back. In 1845, W.E. Gladstone would be appointed to the colonial office, replacing Wilmot's benefactor Stanley, and would quickly become disturbed at the failure of probation in the colony, alongside increasing rumours of homosexuality amongst the convicts. He, alongside Under-Secretary James Stephen, would increasingly study Wilmot for his failings, and though they would side with Wilmot in his conflict with Nixon over whether Nixon should have control over the convict chaplains, Wilmot would not be out of trouble. Stephen, unimpressed by what he perceived as Wilmot's continual failures over the colony's economy and probation, suggested that the governor be recalled. Gladstone would accept this suggestion quickly, and recall Wilmot on the grounds that he had neglected the convict system, while also stating that Wilmot's replacement would be then superintendent of Port Phillip, Charles Latrobe. Alongside this recall, Gladstone would send Wilmot a letter essentially stating that the rumours of his private life made him ineligible for any further jobs in the colonial service. Upon receiving both the recall and the letter by October 1846, Wilmot would become essentially rebellious, stating that he was the victim of the most extraordinary conspiracy that ever succeeded in defaming the character of a public servant. And instead of going back to England, he would stay in the colony to gather evidence against his recall and disqualification for future employment. However, he would quickly become ill with an undiagnosed illness, and die on the 3rd of February 1847, with the Colonial Times newspaper even labelling Wilmot as being murdered only 6 days later. Wilmot's time in charge of Van Diemen's Land was erratic and chaotic, a consequence of his predecessor and of the ongoing economic crisis at the time. However, this wasn't entirely unique at this time. Of course, there is also the end of Governor Gipps' time in charge. Gipps has continued the conflict with the squatters of the New South Wales colony, and despite attempts to rectify the situation with resolutions which benefited both sides, he was perhaps the most unpopular individual in the colony by the middle of 1844. After having published his unofficial regulations, as we discussed last week, Gipps and the squatter colonists would both send letters and petitions to the House of Commons back in Britain. The squatters would use their significant funds to pay for an MP, F. Scott, to personally represent them in Parliament. Despite this, the Colonial Office initially supported Gipps, leading to him feeling confident enough to write to Latrobe that I feel, however perfectly sure, that I shall beat them, and that they will in the end be sorry for what they have said and done, as well as, I am now past the usual term of a colonial government, and may expect a recall ere long. But had I quitted this colony without bringing forward the subject of squatting, and left it to my successor to meet the present storm instead of facing it myself, I feel that I should have had good cause to be ashamed of myself. Indeed, his 6-year term had expired back in February 1844, but the Colonial Office had seen enough value in his governorship to extend his appointment. By June 1845, Gipps would receive approval from Stanley and the Colonial Office for both his regulations, and immediately put them into legislation, though modified. However, he would be disappointed to find out that the Crownlands Amendment Bill, which we had hoped would solve the issue once and for all, had been postponed by December 1845. Throughout this time, the squatters continued to write letters and petitions to London. This pressure would come to pay in dividends for the squatters once Stanley was out of office. Gladstone was far more inclined towards the squatters' demands, and with Gibbs's health declining heavily, he would return to England in July 1846, without his successor, Governor Charles Augustus Fitzroy, having arrived. Gibbs had left the colony, thinking he had won against the squatters. However, during his time on the sea, the Wastelands Act 1846 would be passed. This act, also known as the Australian Lands Act, would give the squatters 14-year-long leases on uncolonised regions, as well as the ability to renew these leases and a right to preempt, which meant that they could lease or essentially coal a plot of land before they had even started squatting it. At the same time, Crown land would remain £1 an acre minimum in colonised areas, essentially giving the squatters everything they wanted while shattering the landowners, leading to their makeshift alliance with the squatters falling apart. Gibbs's return to England would be brief, as he would die on the 28th of February 1847 of a massive heart attack. Both Gibbs and Wilmot's stories demonstrate to us a changing of Australia's politics at this time. Whereas before, the governor could get away with changing legislation and pushing against influential colonists with the knowledge that they'd have the backing from the colonial office, except in disastrous cases like with Bligh and MacArthur, the tides had shifted so much now that the governors were entirely on the back foot. No longer could they work as a singular authoritarian source, and alongside the new democratic legislatures which were appearing, it seems that the downfall of the governors I spoke about many episodes ago is near complete. Next week, we'll take a break from the chronological retelling of Australia's history to talk a bit about our involvement in our neighbours' colonisation. Not well known and rarely retold, we will discuss Australia's role in New Zealand's frontier wars, and how both ideas and men affected the conflict of Pākehā and Māori.